I feel so welcome. Hi, I'm Debbie Sangster, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Debbie.
And I'm really glad to be here. I usually am like, oh, my God, what do I have to share? A lot. Seriously, I have some experience here. But I've been very excited about coming here. It's a fabulous group, and people serious about living this way of life. And Billy and Lynn are dear friends. And Billy just has a way of making you feel like you're a rock star. Like, we're done to hear you. I'm like, whoa, now, wait a minute. That's a lot of, you know, but, you know, it doesn't matter. My experience is my experience, and I'm so grateful for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and a way of life that provides a way for me, a hopeless alcoholic of the hopeless variety with grave emotional and mental disorders, to live, have a way of life that makes sense. And all the folks that have paved the way for me and continue to, I'm just very grateful. So anyway, let's see. Okay, let me go with the statistics here. Sobriety date is May 30th, 2006. That is not, I'm not a one-chip, white-chip wonder. I'm amazed by those people. That is not my original sobriety date. It was back in 98. But, man, I do everything I do to keep it May 30th, 2006. And I have a home group in Richmond. It's Speaking of Steps. We meet on Wednesdays at 8 o'clock. It's a open beginners meeting. And then on Sunday night, we have a closed step meeting. We do a step each month and then a tradition. And that's meeting right now. Getting ready to. I have a member of that home group, have a job in that home group, and I have a sponsor. And she's awesome, Miss Christy. She's been here to speak, and she's been here a while, lives this as a way of life, and I use her. We're very connected, and then I have the great honor and privilege of walking this path with folks and sharing the hope to the hopeless. So those are some of the things that I think are a bare minimum for me to even stay here. But anyway, I'm going to share most. Well, one thing I want to say is that, man, I didn't know what I was dealing with when I first landed in here in 96. I was in and out from 96 to 2006. I didn't know what I was up against. I thought I just had a bad drinking problem, and I thought AA is great for not drinking. But once I started getting some stuff back and feeling a little better, you know, this was just a little bit too much work. I mean, y'all are going a little overboard on this, like this homework, you know. And I always thought I'm a little smarter than a lot of folks, and I made a lot of money and had a big house and nice car, hadn't lost a job, hadn't lost this. So I just kind of, oh, I don't need to quite do what they do. I'm not as bad as them. I'm never going to let it get that bad. And I didn't know what I was dealing with. I thought I had a drinking problem. And man, I got something much bigger than that. It's a hole in my soul that's so big that I can only act like I'm okay for a while, and I'm going to take care of it. I'm going to get some ease and comfort. I'll play with y'all a little bit, but when I'm not feeling good, man, I'm going to put something in it, and I did. I was 6 years sober and relapsed again and almost died, and what I realized of alcoholism, doesn't care how smart you are, doesn't care what a nice do you have, doesn't care how much money you have, doesn't care what. I'm going to steal this from KDP from Texas. It wants me dead, but it'll take me drunk. And it uses my own mind against me. I love, see, it wants me dead, but it'll take me drunk. And it'll take me to a lot of places before it gets me drunk, trying to get some ease and comfort and make myself feel better. It'll take me to Klonopin. It'll take me to all kinds of pills that I think I need because something's wrong with me. Because I just have a drinking problem. And I got to find out I have something else that requires a big power, a power greater than me, in a way of life, to keep me from having to go back to things that will, I think, will fix me. I think I know what I need to be okay, and I don't. But anyway, I realized that I had this thing that was going to kill me, and it used my own mind against me, and it made me think I was okay, and I wasn't as bad as you all. And yeah. People try to tell, you know, Debbie, I don't think that's a good idea. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. And I'm like, you don't know me. I know what's best for me. So anyway, I was able to make it back here. And I'm grateful that I got a full knowledge of my condition. That was the greatest thing I got after relapsing and almost dying after 6 years. I got a full knowledge of what alcoholism is. And drinking, and yeah, I can't do that, but there's, you know, a surrender that happened to me that I surrender to this as a way of life, and then I'm like, oh my God, why did I make it so difficult for so long? So anyway, I'll try to tell you how all that happened. So the accent you hear is Kentucky. I've been away from Kentucky for years, but that's where I grew up, and I was the youngest of three girls, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom, and dad was a bowler maker. It's I don't know if they have any of those around here, but it's a trade, and they work on bowlers or whatever, I don't know. And he, you know, was a workman, blue-collar worker, and, you know, average middle-class type stuff. And, you know, and he was a hard worker. He's a good man, except when he drank, and he was a blackout vodka drinker. So there was, I grew up in a lot of, like, some days it was normal, and then other times it was shotguns and fists going through glass and my mother's face being smattered and the police and, oh, God, it was just really scary. I started having panic attacks when I was 10. And so anyway, you know, just going through this, things, you know, and then what would happen is he would usually would be, you know, he would work during the week. He'd get the paycheck. He would run off to the bars. My mom would load some in the car. We'd go around town looking for him. We'd get him home, and, you know, they'd have fights and just craziness. And it was just very, you know, and there were a lot of secrets that had to be kept and all that type of stuff. And they'd have crazy parties and have wild people over. So I was very scared growing up as a child. And some days I'd get drunk and leave for 3 or 4 days when I was like 10, and I'd be home by myself. And I was just scared, you know, I was just scared. And the reason I'm telling you that, because that kind of plays into, you know, one of the things that kept me from getting sober. So anyway, you know, I go about life, and, you know, that was normal to me. And the first time I ever had a drink was when I was, that I remember. I know there was always alcohol and stuff around. I may have sipped on a beer, but the first time I drank intentionally was when I was 13. And I was about as tall as I am now, which is 5'10". I weighed about 70 pounds and gawky and a nose and feet and hand, you know, I was just gangly. And I started liking boys. I was going to a teen party and I wanted to fit in. And I don't know if this makes me alcoholic. It's just, you know, a lot of kids will do things to try to fit in, and I wanted to drink. So I asked my dad, which it wasn't until I got sober that I realized that that's weird. You ask your dad, a 13-year-old asked your dad to buy you a bottle, and he does. So he bought me. He did. That was my first drink my dad bought for me. He's probably in a blackout. But anyway, I remember he gave me this bottle of whiskey or bourbon or something. It was probably bourbon because we lived in Kentucky and they had all kinds of, you know, bourbon distilleries around there. And I took the whole I drank the whole thing. Like, they poured a cherry Coke. So I remember getting to the party, the room started spinning, and I blacked out. So the very first time I drank, I blacked out. You know, I don't know if normal people do that, you know, but I think this is just my own opinion. It's not an AA, but I think there's something in the, you know, you're either an alcoholic or you're not, and you don't have a shut-off valve. You put in alcohol, and it's just more is better. I've seen normal drinkers, and they're, oh, I'm starting to feel it, and they stop. I'm like, I'm starting to feel it, give me more, you know. And so anyway, I got drunk, and the next day I threw up, and I wasn't one of those people like, I'm going to do this the rest of my life. I don't know what, I just knew I was sick, and, you know. And so I didn't really start drinking, you know, right away. And I was, I really, you know, went through middle school and high school. I don't know. I was, you know, involved in sports and cheerleading, a swimmer and all that. And that was very important to me. You know, my family life was pretty crappy. A lot of kind people would, like, come and take me to church and Sunday school and things like that. You know, my parents were pretty wild, and so I had a lot of people that were really looking out for me, and you know, in clubs and stuff. I was in school, and I was a swimmer and very involved in it, and the coach took good care of us. So anyway, I didn't get in a lot of trouble in high school, but I know I was very popular, and I know now it's because I was such a damn people pleaser, you know. Oh God, you know, you'll bend yourself into 50 different directions to get people to like you because I was so already that hole in my soul. you know, and I felt so different because of stuff going on with my family and, like, other people's families weren't doing the things that were going on. I mean, there was some shady stuff going up in my house. And I ended up being, like, president of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes and captain of the cheerleaders and captain of the swim team. I mean, I was an overachiever, you know, and that was good on the surface. But looking back now, my life depended on that. That was something that, you know, like my drinking is, I had to drink to feel like I was able to breathe the same air because I felt so bad about myself. I overachieved to feel that less than and that God-shaped hole in me that I just felt like I wasn't good enough. I wasn't enough, you know. So the more you achieve, the better you feel. And so anyway, that, you know, that was that. And then I started drinking regularly and you know, like, I guess 17, 18, something like that, and drank and partied and, you know, and then moved to Lexington, Kentucky. I had a bunch of girlfriends that were there. Again, I was from Kentucky. They were all going to UK. I was going to go there and go to school, and I ended up going there, getting a job, and just partying all the time. And then I ended up coming to Richmond, Virginia, because the boy I was dating there in Lexington had gotten a job in Richmond. And, you know, it was in the 80s, and I was like 21, 22, and it was a party every day. And I guess those were the only fun times I had. It was, you know, keg parties and flag football and Bloody Marys and all that, and I didn't have a lot of consequences. But behind all that, you know, I was, you know, out trying to make my way in the, you know, getting jobs and, you know, blah, 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 the stuff that you do in your 20s. And I had a real nervous disposition. I had a lot of panic attacks. I would end up, like when I was 16 years old, I remember I had to be rushed to the emergency room. I didn't smoke, didn't drink. I was a competitive swimmer. I was a cheerleader. And in Kentucky, cheerleaders are like athletes. I mean, we don't just shake pom-poms. It's like serious workout. So I was, like, really in good shape and was rushed to the emergency room because I couldn't breathe. And the doctor's like, "You are the healthiest person I've ever seen in my life. Nothing's wrong with you." So behind all, you know, my life, all through the years, I was constantly, not constantly, but on a regular basis, having to go to the emergency room for this thing. I felt like I was dying. I couldn't breathe, and I felt like I was having a heart attack. And so, you know, they were like, "Nothing's wrong with you." So I started feeling a little crazy. But then I found that drinking really took care of this anticipatory anxiety, because once you have one of those panic attacks, you're kind of a little on edge, you know. And I'm kind of high strung anyway. So I was having that going on in the background, and then, you know, in my 20s, it was just off the races, having, you know, having happy hours all the time, drinking every day, partying and having fun. Got married in 86. And then in 1986, the other thing, it was the first consequence from my drinking, other than probably, I think, getting fired from a job for not being able to show up and lots of hangovers and lots of anxiety. I got a DUI, and I remember that's the first time I really even took a look at my drinking. And I remember it catching my attention that I had to do the ASAP class, and they said, "You cannot drink while you're doing this." I was like, "Oh, no problem." And I remember finding I could not do that. Now, I wouldn't drink on the night of the ASAP class, but it scared me so much, and I wanted to get the hell through that and pass it, not have to deal with it. They didn't send you to AA then, I don't think. But I remember sitting there in that class thinking, I was just the wrong place at the wrong time. There were 150 other people at that party, and they're trying to convince me an alcoholic, and I'm not, you know. So anyway, I made it through that and just proceeded to go on with life and drink and party and continue to have this really bad spells with panic anxiety. And finally, in my late 20s, I had a girlfriend that I drank with that had this nervous disposition too. And she told me, she went to this doctor, and he gave her this little white pill, and it cured it, and she was fine. So I went to him, and he said, "Oh, you've got panic anxiety disorder. Here, take these." So for years, I took a pill. I didn't even know what it was. Now I know it was Ativan, and I know this is AA, but, you know. And I was taking that and drinking, and that's not a good combination, but it, you know, worked for a while. So anyway, I went along, and then I, you know, in 1990, I think I split up with my first husband, and that's when I really was out all the time, bar drinking and partying and all that. And that's when I met my hubby. We were coworkers and happy hours, you know, together and all that, and you know, we're friends. So fast forward, we I got divorced, he got divorced, we got married in 1993. We just celebrated our 23rd wedding anniversary, which is a miracle, and on the 27th. And we were drinking buddies, and we had, you know, had some good times. And but as long as I took my white pill and drank the appropriate amount, you know, but I would still have these panic attacks. But what happened is I got pregnant, and I stopped drinking and stopped to take, because something told me it's probably not a good idea to take these little white pills if you're having a baby. And I ended up being really sick, and now I know, I didn't know then, that I was in withdrawals, you know, and I was pregnant with twins and miscarried one, and I don't know if that's related, but I was very, I mean, you know, like looking back on it now, I'm just horrified. But anyway, one thing that God did do for me during that pregnancy, the smell of alcohol, I had that morning sickness the whole time. Not just in the morning, the entire 9 months, I was so sick, and the smell of alcohol made me deathly ill because Bob was drinking, and I was like, stay away from it. I couldn't even smell it. But the minute I had that child, I mean, I was so mad at him. I remember the baby was born, and they had like this little couple's dinner that they give you filet mignon and all that, and I was like, I am dying for a glass of wine. He didn't bring it. I had apple cider. I was so pissed at him. And I was like, you know, like I was ready. Like I had the baby the morning. So I went, I need the wine. So that was a turning point. After that, so the baby was born in May of 94. By August of 96, I ended up in my first psych ward. Tucker's. Detox. And what happened during that time is, you know, it talks about that this is chronic and progressive. And my experience has been, because I've had a lot of experience with staying stopped for periods of time, starting it again, it takes on a whole new level. And so I would drink, and I was so happy to be drinking again, but then you have a child and you're tired and all that. But after a while, like, it got very unpredictable. I would drink a glass of wine and get really drunk, or I would drink, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, whatever, and couldn't get a buzz, you know. And you know, went back to work, all this, stayed off for a little while with our son, and then I started getting some really bad depression, and the panic attacks were really, really bad. So I went to my OB, and I think by then the child's like at least a year. He said, well, maybe it's some delayed postpartum depression. I'm like, okay, because there is something wrong with me. And he said, here, take these. So I took those, and I got worse, not better. And so what I'm doing, what my drinking looks like at that point is every day, all day, and I started having a drink in the morning, because I can't stand the way I feel in the morning after drinking all night. A little shaky, a little nervous. There's a lot of terror, a lot of impending sense of doom. I like to get on the phone and call people and cause trouble when I'm drinking, and I would wake up with just terror on me. And I realized that in my coffee cup, if I put some vodka and orange juice, like I wouldn't look, I'd pour the vodka in the I would tell myself I was having orange juice. So I started all that. So I started having to drink in the morning. But before that, what I was doing, I was drinking, usually start to have a drink at lunch with coworkers, and sometimes just stay through lunch to happy hour. Drinking every night, big bottles of wine, all kinds of stuff. So I wasn't telling the doctor that, though. So what happened is he ended up sending me to a person that's a doctor that specializes in depression and panic anxiety disorder. And because what he was doing wasn't helping. So I started going under the care of this doctor, and he was trying to help me with all this depression and anxiety and panic attacks. But I'm not really telling him how much I drink. How much do you drink? I'm a social drinker. I have a couple. And he's like, okay. So he starts, you know, loading me up on some stuff. And I start taking it, and I got worse. And so anyway, I ended up, my company I worked for at the time decided that they didn't want us to come to the office in sales. So they wanted to reduce expenses for real estate, and here's your laptop, here's this, here's that, go work from home. Great job for an alcoholic. So by then I would take our son, or Bob would take our son to daycare in the morning, and I could just stay home and drink. And he would go to the office, and so at the end how it looked is after they're gone, I would start on my orange juice and vodka, and I would have two or three of those. Then I would maybe have a rum drink and some juice because he would notice how much vodka was gone. And then I would start in on a 6-pack to a 12-pack of beer and just kind of sip on that all day. And then he would come home from work, and I'd act like, and I would just brown out or whatever, or just, I don't know what I was doing. And then he would have his martini, which was a cup about this big, he calls them a stadium cup, with ice, full of vodka with olive. So he would drink that. Then I would start on a big bottle of Marcus James Chardonnay, not the regular size, but the other size. What is that size? Yeah, the big one. I would drink all that. Then I would start on some red wine. Then I'd drink about a half a bottle of apricot brandy. Because when you drink a lot of wine, your mouth gets real, like, it feels like it's turned inside out. And the brandy just kind of smooth it all out. And I would do that every night, every day. And so finally what happened is I was very depressed. I was kind of, thinking about suicide. Because here was the deal. I had a great job making good money. We had built our dream home, a beautiful home. I had a brand new car in the garage. I had the man. And, you know, the last thing that I needed, because I knew what was wrong with me, and I don't know if you're like me, there's always something wrong, and, like, if I get that, I'm going to be okay. So I kept going after, and I'm good at getting stuff. So I got the man. I got the house. I got the right car. I got the job. I got the money. Oh, God, I need a damn baby. That's what it is, you know. So I have the child, and I remember in that beautiful home and looking at that crib at that baby, and thinking, oh, my God, what is wrong with me? There is something so wrong with me. I have everything that I ever thought that I wanted or needed to be okay, and I'm not okay. And I couldn't go to the office or talk to my colleagues and say, hey, did you drink yourself to oblivion and piss on yourself last night and drive around drunk with your baby and, like, do you feel depressed? You know, you can't talk to people about that stuff, you know. And you know, I was really starting to scare myself. But when that happens, for me, my only solution is just drink it away. And so finally at the end, I was just, oh, my God, it was awful. And finally one day I don't know what it was, but somebody said something about my drinking. I got mad, but I realized that's not normal drinking. But every day I was like, I'm going to do something about it tomorrow. So one of those days I woke up and I saw myself in the mirror for the first time. I was bloated and red-faced and, you know, drinking myself into oblivion every day. And so I said, you know what, I'm just not going to drink today, and I'm going to go. So I worked from home, but they had like an office, like a drop-in spot where I could go and work every day if I wanted, and the secretaries and all that. My plan was I'm going to get dressed and go to the office. Well, I tried to get dressed, and I had the shake so bad, I couldn't get any of my clothes. I gained so much weight, was so bloated from drinking, I didn't realize it. I mean, I was not in reality anymore. So I looked at myself in the mirror again. I looked awful. So here's my solution of my best effort of, I know drink is the problem. These doctors have been lying to them. They're giving me all these pills. Nothing's helping. I need to stop drinking. I couldn't do it. I went up to the liquor store and got my own secret bottle of vodka so I could drink the way I wanted without having to worry. It's too much trouble to worry about the levels of the bottles when you need a drink. Because, see, he didn't know how much I was drinking. I was pretty good at hiding it. God knows how. I think I had that martini ready for him when he came to the door so he'd get that in him so he wouldn't notice how messed up I was. But anyway, so what happened is I'm like, you know, okay, got my bottle, got home. I'm just going to go to the office where I'm going to deal with this tomorrow. Right now I need a drink. And then what happened, and it was the first time it had happened, I could not get that feeling I needed, and I don't know if any of y'all know what it is, but that you're going to come apart, mm-hmm. and you're shaken, and then you get that drink, and you're like, okay, all right. Then, you know, I can settle down and get my plans going and get myself together and start figuring out. Well, that wouldn't happen. My mind got worse. The more I drank, the more my mind got, I mean, I felt like I was going insane. I started pulling my, and so I was being seen by the Tucker psychiatric people, this, you know, people that were specialists, and I called them. I'm like, I am losing. Oh, my God. So they told me to come to Tucker's. So I ended up there at Tucker's, and that's the local hospital, the local psych ward there that, it's a psychiatric ward, and they also do detox. And literally, I thought that I was having a nervous breakdown because I've been talking to my, well, let me just tell you this. If you have a drinking problem, don't talk to other people with drinking problems about your problem because you'll get some bad advice. Or don't talk to people that don't have alcoholism and are well-meaning because they will give you bad advice. But I've been talking to them, and they said, well, I think you're having early menopause. I think that you need to be nicer to your husband. I think that you just need to cut back a little, or, you know, stuff like that. So I end up going there to Tucker's and thinking I was having a nervous breakdown, and they processed me and then took me up to the ward, and I'm like, and I mean, I was just heaving and crying, embarrassed and humiliated, and what's wrong with me? And then I looked and I said, what is wrong with me? And they looked at me point blank and said, you're an alcoholic. I'm like, I was so offended. It struck me just like, I'm like, hey, this is what came out. I am not. I'm an account executive at AT&T. They're like, put her over there, you know, thinking. I mean, I don't know why. I would even, you know, it's crazy. So anyway, I stayed there for 10 days, and I am so grateful for that. There's a couple reasons I'm grateful. Well, it probably saved my life. When they found out the levels I was drinking, that I was taking all those pills that I was taking that the doctor prescribed, which it wasn't his fault. And please, God, for if anybody thinks I'm trying to talk about meds or what you should do about your meds, I don't have no opinion on it. I'm just telling you my experience. You know, I think those things are good for people that have those things. I had alcoholism and wasn't telling, you know, anybody. So anyway, Billy, where was I? What was I just saying right before that? Okay, 10 days in, and they educated me on alcoholism and how lucky I was to be alive with the levels of benzodiazepines and booze. They said the only two things that can kill you, well, that's a bad combination. It kills a lot of people, and those are the only two things that can kill you, detoxing off of them. And I did not know that. I mean, because, you know, I have secrets. I don't tell people what I'm doing. And I don't even think he knew I was taking that stuff. But anyway, so they got me detoxed, and they also had a family program, and they talked to Bob. It was a little more of a, like a mini rehab type thing. And it was very helpful. But the most important thing that happened there was the members of Alcoholics Anonymous brought a meeting in there. And I started to stay in my room because I'm not an alcoholic. I'm just having a nervous breakdown, you know, early on. By the time I left there, I figured I was probably an alcoholic. But I went ahead and went to the meeting, and I said, it's probably going to be a bunch of old men. And it was. But they started talking, and they started putting labels to the crazies in my head. It caught my attention because of all these secrets. You know, when you're trying to present to the world that you're an account executive and you got your shit together and, you know, on the PTA and all that, and secretly I'm like a damn crazy drunk. But, you know, I front well. And so I have a lot of secrets. And when they start talking about the thinking and the drinking and how no matter what they drank anyway, and it didn't have anything to do with how much they loved their son or their wife or their mother or whatever, that they were powerless over it. I mean, I was like, oh, my God, that's me. Like, I don't want to be doing this. I don't want to be drinking like this and blackouts with my baby. He was 2 at the time, I guess. Yeah. I mean, he was the most important thing in the whole world to me. I would die for that kid, you know, and it helped explain a lot of stuff. So it caught my attention enough. And they kept talking about this big book, blue book, big book. And I'm like, what are y'all talking about? What is this blue book? And they said, it's a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, well, I want one of those. So they bought me one. So I got out of there, and I was scared enough about my drinking. They had raised enough for me to consider that I was an alcoholic. So I started going to meetings and loved the fellowship. And, I mean, you know, alcoholism is a lonely thing, and especially when you're having to keep so many secrets and present. You know, I could go and be open, and these people talked about themselves, and, you know, I told them about myself, and we could laugh together. And so, you know, I really liked it. And then I waited 3 months to get a sponsor because I was trying to find someone I could relate to. And I would go around to a lot of the meetings, and there are so many people in Richmond like to go around. And I would like to use the group as my personal therapy, and I like to talk about my feelings, and I like to be very inappropriate, and I like to talk about a lot of things that you really shouldn't. Finally, people were like, do you have a sponsor? You should get one, you know. So finally, I got one. I think that's why I liked AA so well the first 3 months, because, you know, I didn't have anybody tell me what to do, and I loved all the people. I'd go around just, at the meetings and take over the meeting and get up and down and get, you know. Anyway, those people are cute. I was cute. But anyway, so I got a sponsor. She started setting forth some actions that we needed to take, and at first I was willing to do it, but then I got busy. And what happened is I you know, my life was getting better. I was feeling better. I'd lost a lot of weight. I was working better. Everything was going better. My husband still was drinking, but, you know, I had a child, it just got to be too much to go to so many meetings. She wanted me to go to a minimum of 3 and get a home group. And I remember, and this is how sick it is, I just want to show you where I was. So it was a meeting that I think I was making my home group. And here was my thinking on meetings. They read how it works in the traditions, in the promises every single time. I got it. So I can come 15 minutes late to get past all that because I don't have time to sit and listen to that. So one night after the meeting, she said, Debbie, I think it would be nice. I think that you should get here about a half an hour to 15 minutes before the meeting and start connecting with people. I'm like, you don't understand. You're lucky I'm here. I'm busy. I swear to God, that's what I said to her. She was not any of the current sponsors that you know. She was this very nice lady that I picked, and she's like, okay. Well, so anyway, I end up leaving. I was like, I don't have time for this, and I'm not as bad as them, and I'm never going to let it get that bad. Well, what do you think happened? It got that bad, and it got worse. I was out 11 months, and somehow on November the 12th of 1998, that night, I remember hearing my husband, a friend of mine called on the regular telephone. That's where, you know, cell phones were real big, and I picked up. He said, I don't know what to do. She's drinking herself to death, and I got so mad I was going to run up from downstairs. He was upstairs or somewhere, and I was going to hit him and tell him he was wrong. And what I did is I hung up the phone and I dropped him and I said, God, please help me. I knew it was true. I mean, you can't, you know, the way I was drinking, you know, vodka every morning and, you know, beer all day long and wine all night and take a bit, you know, I mean, I really consider myself very, I mean, I can't believe I'm alive. I can't believe I survived it. So anyway, I called a member of AA that had, because I'd met some folks, you know, and a gal named Val that was a good member of AA, and I called her and I said, I need help. And it was Friday the 13th of November, and I knew that she was going to tell me to hang on and come to the Jaywalkers meeting at 7, and I knew there was no way. I was beyond, I could not drink. And what she did, though, and I'm eternally grateful for, so I'll be right there. And she came and 12-stepped me, and we talked and went to lunch and all that, went to the meeting. I needed to be detoxed. What happened, we ended up, I think I ended up having to go in the hospital or to a doctor, and they detoxed me with some phenobarb because I was pretty messed up. And then I proceeded to work this, you know, to get involved in the program and be under the direction of a strong sponsor. and started doing the deal, working the steps. She got me helping people immediately, a home group immediately, a job in the, you know, being in the middle of the circle and the triangle and all three parts, and, you know, the accountability of a sponsor. And, you know, we didn't wait for me to get through the steps, start helping people. I started helping them right away. So I had a great experience until about 3.5 years. And I tell you, I see I sponsor a lot of people, man. I don't know if everybody, I see between, you know, 2.5 to 3.5 years, like, you know, something happens. And I love to steal other people's stuff because sometimes they say it so good. Bob D talks about how the shine wears off, you know. Like, everybody's so excited when they first come here because people want to talk to you and you're working the steps and it's all about you and your inventory and your sponsor listens to all your stuff and it's me, and, you know. And it's, you know, fun when you're, you know, going through that first year. And then the first time you're asked to speak and then somebody asks you to sponsor them, and, you know, it's all kind of magical, you know. And then all of a sudden you're at 2 years and you've spoken a bunch of times and you're sponsoring a bunch of people, and you're looking like, you know, then I got this thing, I'm like, this is all y'all got for me? Like, I am not feeling happy, joyous, and free like you people are talking about, you know. And I thought something was wrong with me. I thought that I had missed the steps wrong, or I didn't do them good enough. But I wasn't telling my sponsor that I was feeling so bad. A little bit, but, you know, I think that I was so afraid that this, I don't know what I thought, but I wasn't being, it talks about that rigorous honesty, you know, and people say, how you doing? I'm great, and I'm, you know, sponsoring a bunch of people, I'm doing this, I'm speaking, but inside I'm dying, and I'm not really talking about that because I think I'll look bad or something, I don't know, it's stupid, but anyway, so about 3.5 years, the anxiety and the depression came back full throttle, and I'd gotten off that. But again, I thought, you know, these damn people in AA aren't doctors, and I know I need that stuff because if I keep feeling this way, I'm going to drink. And, you know, so I fired her and got another sponsor and started going down the psychotropic route again. And at 5 years sober, not drinking, I end up in a psych ward at St. Mary's. I felt like I had the worst panic attack. I drove myself there. I'm like, I'm going to kill, I can't stand it. I mean, I just came apart. And I was there, and then they loaded me up even more. And then the rest is kind of a blur. And I know I picked up my 6-year chip, and 3 days later, I picked up a drink. And it's just all such a blur. So that's when I went to a level head, but mainly not me, because I wasn't there. I was out of it. But, you know, putting my husband and my son and the people in AA that love me, for them to see. It's hard to watch people die. It's hard to see people kill themselves. And so I ended up, Bob was out of the country at that time. Our son had never seen me drink. And he is a member of AA now, 3.5 years sober. And he told me, were you there the other night when Ronnie spoke? No, it don't, yeah. But he talks about a story how he had never seen his mother drink, and he said, and it terrified me. The first time I heard him tell a story, I cry out of gratitude. I terrified my only son that I adore, that I love, with my drinking. And so anyway, Bob was out of the country trying to start a company for a great opportunity he had for a job. He was in Vancouver, British Columbia. I was supposed to be at our home taking care of our son and packing up our home because we were going to move there. We were getting another house in Richmond. Eventually, we were going to move there. And all I did was lay up drunk all summer. My son, it's all a blur. And my son was 11. And he was unsupervised. He was a skateboarder. He evidently fell and cracked his head open. I don't know about that. Kids were in and out of the house. I mean, it was awful. And his sponsees would come over and peer in the windows and check the trash cans. You know, finally what happened is I tried to come back. I kept trying to come back to AA. And I remember when I, you know, started drinking again in 2004 after being sober for 6 years, you know, I couldn't believe I did it. You know, and the very next day I came to AA, I picked up a white chip, but I just couldn't make it. I mean, I was like, and I try to warn people that have time that relapse, and none of them want to hear what I have to say, but it's like, you don't even know you better hold on to your ass because the demons are big now. I mean, the longer you're sober and you drink again, it is bad. I mean, I don't know what, there was no hope. There was no hope. And I thought that I had worked AA. I'd been a good AA member. I'd worked that. I can recite the book backwards and forwards. I sponsor people. I spoke at stuff. I cooked turkeys and brought them to the Alcathon. I mean, I was very active in AA. And, I mean, that lessened, you know, towards the end. But I thought that I could come back when I wanted to. And I was like, screw this. I can't stand all these people and the looks they're giving me. And these people I sponsored now, they got more time than me. Oh, my God. And I'm like, I'm just going to go ahead and get it out of my system and I'll come back. And that almost didn't happen. I'd cut off everybody in AA. My husband was out of the country. And I was just holding, I was drinking around the clock, and I would try to quit. And my best effort at that time was I didn't even bother in the morning making orange juice and vodka. I would take the vodka bottle, chug it to get the relief as tears are pouring out of my eyes. God, please help me. God, please help me. I mean, unable, no matter what, to not drink. So that's where my alcoholism is. I mean, I am powerless, and there's no way. I can't make up my mind not to drink. That is, I've lost that ability. So what ended up happening is there was this kind of recovery-friendly church that Bob and I had been involved in for many years, and the folks were good friends of ours, and I wasn't really participating there anymore, but they knew I was drinking. What happened, there was a woman that was my age, because I was 45 at the time, and so was she. She was a beautiful woman, and her child and my child were buddies, and she had been in and out for years and tried to stay sober, and she blew her brains out, and it scared, and they knew I was next. I mean, you know, she just couldn't surrender. And so they came and checked on me, and they kindly took my son and said, oh, we're taking him to play with the kids over here. And then the next day some women came, and I thought they were coming to, because church people are so nice, I thought they were coming to help me pack up my home, because that's what I was supposed to be doing for the movers. And they packed me up and took me to a hospital. And I was so airy, so out of it. They found me face down in the floor when they got there. And somebody was supposed to be there watching me, and they left. And I was out of booze, and I had the shakes. And so they were like, well, I said, I need some booze. And they're like, okay, well, she talked to one of the other girls on the phone. I remember saying, bring her one of those tall boys. I said, I don't think you understand. You better bring a 12-pack at least. And they were trying to convince me to go to the hospital. I was trying to convince them that I'm going back to AA, and I know all about AA, and I'm going to be fine. They're like, no. Those ladies were so kind. They let me sit there and drink all that beer and smoke cigarettes as I'm trying to decide whether I'm sick enough to go to the hospital. The delusion. So they finally convinced me to go, and I went over there. And that's I was in bad shape. If I'd say, I would be dead. I mean, I was out of reality. You know, I drink for oblivion. I don't like to feel like Debbie's little bubble world of where everything makes sense to me and to nobody else. That's where I like to get. So they put me in the hospital, and things started moving. And Bob had to come back from Vancouver, and AA moved my entire home while I was in rehab. They convinced me to go to rehab. I didn't want to do that either. Nope, I know all about AA. And they're like, well, we think you need a timeout. So I went to rehab, and then I came back. And, man, I tell you what, it took me to be in the hospital. What, I was in there about a week? I can't remember. I think it was about a week. And then they took me to the Father Martin's. I was still in detox there for a while. I was loaded up on so many things, and they had to detox me and get me straight. And I think I had been there in the hospital for a week or so, and then 2 weeks there till I finally came to. And I was like, oh, my God. I felt like I came up from under, you know, like a murky pond that all the dirt's all in the water and you can't see. And then I came up and saw the truth. I can't believe I'm able to talk about it without crying, because the pain, it is still so with me, and I hope I never lose it, of the horror of coming to reality, because delusion's a strong thing. We can think we're okay. That's why when people lie to you about their drinking or tell you they didn't do this or that, they're not lying in their mind. It's delusion. They believe it. And I believed my own mind. And I was a very sick woman, didn't know it. I thought I was okay. So I came to and cried for like 2 or 3 days just hysterically, like, oh, my God. And I was like, God, please let me get back to AA. And so I did that. I left. I thought I was surrendered again. And that was September 18th, 2005 was one of the sobriety dates. And then I drank again. I was about 8.5 months sober, and that's by May 30th, because here's what happened. This is what always happens to me. When my ass is on fire, I am willing to do what y'all say. I'm willing to show up. When things start getting a little bit better, or I get depressed, or I don't feel good, I'm going to stay home. I give in to the depression. So I started getting into the depression because my life was a wreck. I had racked up financial harm. My son was disgusted with me. I started having trouble with him. He had started smoking pot, and he was like, you drank, and that's why I won't do my homework. You know, just the shame and guilt that a mother, everybody has, but a mother, you know. I had so much shame and guilt, and I was hanging around the person that wasn't too well, because a lot of the well people were like kind of, I scared people, and people were a little icy towards me. I don't think they were like, ooh, because I've been in and out so much. Sometimes we're hard to love. It's not that people want to be mean, but they're like, let's watch and see what happens here, you know. And I hung around with a girl that wasn't too healthy, and we had our own little world, and we started judging people in AA and judging that. I mean, pretty soon there's no meetings to go to because she doesn't like them. Well, she doesn't like them. I don't like them. And, yeah, they were kind of mean to me. She looked at me wrong, and those bitches, I'm not going there, and they're a clique, and they're a cult, and they're this. And, you know, so I said, we're having our own meetings in her house, and she's popping pills. So, anyway, we went to Virginia Beach for the weekend to take our kids there, and we got Tutti Frutti Virgin Daiquiris all weekend, and all of a sudden it was my turn to go get our two, because they still charge the same amount whether you have alcohol in them or not. And I went up to get our Virgin Daiquiris, and I looked at them. I said, you know what, that one, go ahead and put the alcohol in. That easy. And so I started drinking, and then I excused myself. I drank that down. I said, I got to get back in the room. I went over to the 7-Eleven and got a 12-pack and sat on the park bench and downed it. Well, I don't think I got to drink all 12 before I had to leave, but I drank a bunch of them and was off to the races. And then what happened is I drank for a few days. My son was so disgusted with me and so mad. He called a member of AA to come get him. And this guy, I mean, we are close. We are close. I love him. I love my son. And then Bob found out. And I knew he was. He had already stood by me. I'm telling you what I put that man through. If he had done to me what I did to him, I would have divorced him. But anyway, he was a sober member of AA and, you know, the mother of his child. And I guess he loved me. I was very unlovable. But anyway. So what happened that night after my son was gone, I was laying there. Of course, you know, leading up to that, all that, I wouldn't call my sponsor. I wouldn't show up at the meetings because I was depressed. And, you know, I wasn't doing any of that stuff and hanging out with this guy. It wasn't her fault at all, you know. And that night I remember thinking, I'm just, AA doesn't work. God doesn't like me. My life is crap, and I want to die. And I went into the kitchen to look at the knives, and I, for some reason, picked up a serrated knife, and I even put it on my skin. I was like, that's not going to work. That's going to make a big mess. I will end up in a psych ward, and I won't be able to smoke my cigarettes. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm just telling you, you know, if you want to know it in the same mind, I'm sharing it with you. So anyway, I laid there and I just was like, God, I don't know. And I you know, it was the weirdest time. And I called my sponsor the next morning, and she's a lovely lady. I said, Christy, I said, you shouldn't, you know, I said, I haven't called you. I said, I drank. She said, okay. Well, what are you willing to do? What do you want to do? Are you done? I said, I want to be done. I keep telling you I'm done, but clearly I'm not. And she said, well, what are you willing to do? I said, anything you tell me. She said, will you come tonight to the Wednesday meeting and pick up a white chip? We'll take it from there. So that's what I did. And that was May 30th, 2006. And, you know, it was tough. It was really tough. I was in bad shape physically. I'd done a lot of damage to my marriage. But, you know, I started using my sponsor. So she walked me through these hard times. I mean, it's hard getting sober, you know. Like, putting down the drink Well, that's hard for me. I have to be separated from it via, you know, psych wards. But you know, the shame and guilt, you know, that's why I drown. I want to look at that stuff. And so she took me by the hand, and I love Chrissy. She said, I'm going to take your hand and walk you through these 12 steps, and you're going to walk out of a hell you never thought you'd get out of. And I was like, sign me up. So, you know, so we you know, she wasn't as concerned about how, I mean, she was very compassionate, but she was way more concerned on my actions and about showing up and about commitments and about connecting in with people. You know, I want to connect with them, come to me like, then go off and do what I'm doing. But I had to start connecting with people. I really believe the disease breeds in isolation, and I can be isolated coming to meetings if I'm not engaging with other folks and with my sponsor. And the recovery happens in community. I got to have you guys. I got to be a part of this deal. So my sponsor is big on being in the middle of the circle, the triangle. And, you know, the unity, the service, and the recovery are the three sides. I don't know if we have any of those. But, you know, she told me that this is what we're going to do. We're going to be right in the middle of this circle, the triangle. And, you know, the unity part is, you know, engaging, you know, in the meetings, the fellowship, the group, my home group, you know, minimum of 4 meetings a week, having a home group, having a job in that home group. You don't miss your group. You don't miss your meetings. In other things that we do, our sponsorship family does a lot of stuff. It's a commitment, the second and fourth Thursday, 6:30. And then the recovery is a process of the 12 steps. And so we're going to go through those. And, you know, then the service, you know, being of service now also, but also the main thing to me, being of service to another alcoholic. Whatever I can do to give hope to the hopeless, to carry this message, that is my job description. And she said, if you take actions, not thinking about it, not wishing about it, not theorizing, but taking these actions as described in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, you can become whole, your mind, body, and your spirit. And I love the 12 and 12 in the beginning. It talks about how, I think it's one of the greatest promises that we have. It says, AA is a program of the steps, I'm not doing it, they're spiritual in nature, but when practiced as a way of life, which means all the time, not just an hour at the meeting, a way of life enables the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And that's been my experience, much to my surprise. Because I tell you, when I came back here, what I had done, I guess the other thing that's coming to me now is I knew this had something to do with God, and I knew my experience with it was I like God, you know, because I was using what I thought I knew about God, which was, you know, religious upbringing, just like everybody. And then I went ahead and created what a spiritual Debbie was going to look like. And so I ran off and did some things at church. And at one time years ago, I was a Big Book thumper and a Bible thumper, and it was quite annoying. And I just didn't understand why we could talk about that in AA. That's just wrong. But anyway, I learned. That was a long time ago. People like to remind me of that too. But so when I relapsed, you know, and kept drinking, I thought that, well, a lot of people say, I hate God. Like, poor God. All he does is try to help us when he doesn't like me. He's too busy to worry about what liking me or not. But anyway, what I realized is I had to let go of everything I thought I knew about anything, especially spiritual matters. And that's when We Agnostics became my favorite chapter. I thought before, I was like, oh, well, yeah, I'm not an agnostic, so I don't need to pay attention to that. And I guess I didn't pay attention to it. But I tell you what, you become as open-minded when you're dying from this disease and you see new things. The book even talks about that we're beaten into a state of reasonableness. We soon become as open-minded on spiritual matters as we have others. And I had a whole new experience with We Agnostics, where it talks about having setting aside prejudice 7 times in there. I have people I sponsor circle it. We look it up, and it's basically the prejudice they're talking about is, I think I know what's going on. I'm making a decision based on what I think I know. It's the way I interpret it. So when I use that, when reading that, it's like, yeah. And it keeps telling me that I need to have a new experience. I have to let go of everything I know about anything. So I started doing that. I was like, okay, I'm setting aside that I want it to be this person or that person, you know, or the Pope or whoever, you know, as far as religious. I realized it was a spiritual, not a religious thing here. And I kept making it religious because that satisfied my ego and my mind. And there's nothing wrong with that, but that's not what we do here. It's about having a whole new experience. So I was so emptied out that I was a perfect candidate because I didn't believe in God and I didn't believe in AA. But I believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as I was living it, and I knew I was going to die, and I became willing to take the actions despite what I think, feel, or believe. My sponsors show up, just keep showing up. Man, I had some tough days, but I showed up anyway. And every time I was going to stay home because I was depressed, because I base it on how I feel, and God, if they see me depressed, so what? But, you know, I got a front. I'd go anyway. It's exactly what I needed. And I was exactly where I needed to be, and that's how I started connecting with people. But anyway, so I had, the ability to set aside. And I said, there is a power today, 9.5 years later. I don't understand it, can't describe it, but I know I'm going to be okay no matter what. Man, I wouldn't give you $1 million. You can give me $1 million to take that away. I thought y'all had, you know, it was a bunch of crap, and maybe it'll work for Billy because he's nice, but not me. But I'm telling you, if you take the actions, I don't want to tell y'all what to do. For me, I was willing to take the actions. I was willing to be honest, and I was willing to be open-minded. That's those essentials or requirements that just came to me. The essentials or requirements are honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And the honesty for me was not telling you the politically correct answer, but telling you what I'm really thinking, what I'm really feeling, and what I am really doing in my life. And that's what I require of the people I sponsor. I don't care if you're, I'm probably nice, what you're doing, you don't want to keep any secrets, let me know, let's take a look at that. You know, you got to be honest because it might take you out if you're not. We don't lead a double life here anymore, and you're drunk, so nothing's going to, you know, I won't judge you. I've heard it all, I tell you. Nothing surprises me. It surprises me if you're nice and you're not doing things sketchy if you're early in recovery. So, and then, you know, the open-mindedness is being willing to have a new experience, being willing to say maybe I'm wrong, not getting so attached to my thinking and what I think I know. And then the willingness is all shown by my actions, whether I show up or not, or making excuses or whatever. So that's the only thing I think I've done right is I've been honest and I've continued to show up. My life is incredible as far as in peace of mind. Now, that doesn't mean, oh, God, I can be quite edgy some days, but we have a solution for every problem. I've got to end here. I just want to say that I'm very grateful for my husband. He drove me here. He's been a great member of Alcoholics Anonymous. His sponsor, former sponsor, is like, it is a miracle you all are married, what we've been through. His alcoholism, my alcoholism, and our son's alcoholism. We're pretty strong today, I'd say, and I really have a lot of respect and love for him, and it's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the center of our life. The thing that I love the most in the whole entire world is my son, Rice, and he started having a problem when he was 15 years old, and I thought I was going to die. I mean, because I know I got a full knowledge of my condition. I know about the disease, and I know if you don't treat it, what happens? And, man, I don't want that to happen to my son. He didn't want it, and finally, at the age of 18, he came in here, and it was scary. And I handed him over to the people of AA, and he got a sponsor and all that. And he's been sober since August 4th of 2012. And he's a great member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I am so lucky. I'm so blessed to live in a family that we try to live this as a way of life. And when we're not living his way of life, we have step 10 as sponsors, thank God. But, but anyway, I just hope that, this has been helpful. I've really enjoyed it, and I thought I wouldn't have much to say, and I'm ending like I should have stopped 5 minutes ago. But, Billy, thank you so much. I love you guys, and I appreciate it.